9. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Last week, in a 6-3 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that federal law prohibits any employment discrimination against people who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. This landmark decision saw two of the court's conservative justices join the four liberals in determining that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 includes employment protections of LGBT people, in addition to forbidding discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law professor Jack Harrison is an expert in the field of employment discrimination and was a partner at Frost Brown Todd, where he was the first openly gay person elected partner at a large Cincinnati law firm. He's on the phone with us now. Jack Harrison, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm so appreciative that you can be here. First, we had a little discussion internally. We're not a law firm. We're curious, is amicus brief or amicus brief?
It depends on, actually, regionally, but normally it's going to be amicus.
Okay, well, I'll switch my pronunciation to that, and I apologize.
Either way.
Well, now to further our elementary legal education very quickly, what is that? Tell us exactly what you did, what your participation in it was.
Sure. Often when particularly high-profile cases come to the Supreme Court, but also to courts of appeals as well, others outside of the parties will submit briefs. Basically friend of the court briefs, which is why they're called amicus briefs, on both sides, depending on which side of the case. And those briefs will be used to supplement arguments that the parties have made, to provide often historical context that the parties, because the parties are dealing with the page limits of set by the Supreme Court. So there are lots of things that the parties might want in their briefs that they can't include. And so sometimes amicus briefs will pick some of that up. And then at times they're offered on behalf of businesses or business groups who want to take a position in a particular piece of litigation on appeal.
We're talking with Jack Harrison, who is a professor of law at Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law. Please go on if you were continuing, Jack. I apologize.
Yeah. I mean, just in terms of my involvement in this particular case, this is an issue that I have done scholarship in for several years and also taught in the area of sexuality, sexual orientation, and the law. So it's an area of interest to me. As a gay person, it's an area of personal interest. But as the chair of the section of the American Association of Law Schools that deals with sexual orientation and gender identity issues, a number of us got together at the beginning, about this time last year, and began to talk about putting together amicus brief in these cases. And so there were, our brief was on behalf of professors of history and law. So we had both historians and a couple of law professors as well involved in the process. So Over about a month, we wrote and edited and submitted July of last year.
And in some of your writing on this topic, Jack, you note that same-sex couples won marriage equality through the Obergefell ruling in 2015, but could still be fired legally from their jobs in a great many places across this country. And there are certainly no statewide protections in Kentucky, though some local municipalities, particularly in Northern Kentucky in the past couple of years, have been expeditiously adopting local ordinances, but still no statewide protections. What does this ruling mean? Does this mean there's no longer a need for the statewide protection because it exists at the federal level?
I think there's still a need, certainly at the state level, in the area of employment and in other areas as well. But certainly here, one of the things about Title VII is it only reaches businesses of a particular size. Some state anti-discrimination laws reach smaller businesses, and so there's some coverage gap there. So I think it's still important for states to continue to pursue this issue. I mean, it's about a little more than half the states have statewide protections at this point, but that left about 50% of LGBTQ persons in the country uncovered in terms of protections from job discrimination at least as of until last Monday.
So based on your research in this area, your expertise in this area, and then your active participation in the form of the amicus brief, were you surprised at the outcome of the court's ruling?
It's interesting that I think those of us who have studied this, and I think when you think about the way the briefing came together, strategically, I think everyone was thinking that if there was a fifth vote to be had, that would read the text of Title VII that prohibits discrimination because of sex as being broad enough to include sexual orientation and gender identity, that Justice Gorsuch would be that fifth vote. And I think most of the briefing and the oral argument as well, if you look at that from last October, was really targeted toward Justice Gorsuch. Reputation as a textualist, and also the way he employed textualism in interpreting statutes. So I guess I was cautiously optimistic going into, as we waited over the last few weeks for a decision to come down, but you never know. Chief Justice Roberts was admittedly a surprise.
So both conservatives, Chief Justice Roberts appointed by President George W. Bush, Neil Gorsuch, of course, appointed more recently by President Trump. And you use the term textualism, and that's something that anyone who's read any news about this case, and at least in the form of analysis about why certain justices might have voted the way they did, that's the term that's attached to Gorsuch on this, especially for those who weren't as surprised at the outcome. Explain to us in elementary terms again what that means.
Sure, and I think, to be honest, if you look at the opinions, particularly Justice Alito's dissent and Justice Gorsuch's opinion for the court, you see two real different approaches to text. A literal textualist, as Gorsuch is, simply looks at the words on the page in the text, in this case, prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sex, and then looks at the factual scenario in the case before him and sees if those words reach this situation. For example, in Justice Gorsuch's mind, if you have John and Jane both working for the same employer, John dates women, Jane dates women. Jane gets fired for dating women, John doesn't get fired for dating women. Therefore, Jane is treated differently than John on the basis of her gender. If she were a man and dated women, she'd be fine. Whereas Justice Alito's approach to textualism is, and he makes this very clear in the dissent, that one has to look at textualism from the standpoint of what was in the minds of the legislators at the time they adopted Title VII in 1964. And so you've got two competing ideas of textualism at play there in these decisions.
And we're talking with Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law Professor Jack Harrison. Jack, in the amicus brief that you presented, there's a local case that is referenced in this, Barnes v. Cincinnati. Can you give us a little bit of background on that and how it was relatable to the arguments from last week's ruling?
Yeah, I mean, that's the case. I mean, part of the issue here has been, and the Sixth Circuit has been, like the Harris Funeral Home case came out of the Sixth Circuit, the Cincinnati Felicia Barnes case, similar and again dealt with issues of discrimination in areas of sexual orientation, gender identity. And there you began to see some movement in the court, at least in the language used in the direction of reaching this discrimination. So I think that was, there were a number of cases that sort of led up to this this case being in the Supreme Court. So it's interesting kind of looking at the development over time of the law in this area.
When marriage equality became recognized in 2015 through a Supreme Court ruling, you know, we can look back now and see that that was 5 years ago. And 5 years later, you can't go into just any church and ask for a same-sex marriage. You can be turned away from having any ceremony performed if the church objects. How do religious exemptions play into, or possibly play into, if we don't know yet, this Title VII ruling as it relates to LGBT protections?
Yeah, I think when we think about it, I do think that will be sort of the issues coming down the road. I mean, I think part of the issue will be, for example, in the churches, as you talked about in the case of marriage. Well, when the Loving decision came down, indicating that interracial couples could be married and that they could not be barred, and that came down in 67. At that time, any church who, on religious grounds, and there were plenty of them, who believed that interracial marriage was somehow against their deeply held religious belief, didn't have to perform those marriages. Same is true post Obergefell. Now, in the employment context, there have always been. Well, not always, but at least recently, have been some religious exemptions recognized, what is called the ministerial exemption, so that churches whose religious beliefs are that, that homosexuality is sinful, or that homosexual marriage is sinful and wrong, they're not certainly required to hire ministers, for example, who believe differently. Or other persons within the church who are in ministerial functions. That's an issue that comes up in a number of the Catholic school cases. You know, is a basketball coach a minister under the ministerial exception? One can argue about that, and those arguments take place all the time. The bigger issue, it seems to me, which is the issue that came up in Harris Funeral Home, is that I'm a secular business. I'm a funeral home. I don't have a particular religious function. Or I'm a restaurant, or I'm a corporation. I have an employee who is gay. I feel that I personally, as the manager, feel that it is it's somehow immoral, and that my religious belief says I can't hire this person. Well, should my individual religious belief trump the right of this employee not to be discriminated against? Those are going to be the cases that come down, which are completely different, for example, than Hobby Lobby, where the Supreme Court said a corporation who has a defined religious belief or interest can act as a corporation. But that's different than an individual manager in a workplace. So I think those are going to be the cases to come, and are going to be really fascinating to see what the court does with it. Hard to predict at this point.
Professor Harrison, you have spent the past few years focusing on what you refer to as the intersection of LGBTQ persons and discrimination in education and employment. And you wrote an article a few years back called "To Sit or Stand, Transgender Persons, Gendered Restrooms, and the Law." And a lot of times when there are just, I mean, if there's either serious discussion or random social media chatter about transgender people, it's about bathrooms and access to bathrooms and who should be using the bathrooms. I'm wondering, does this ruling stop that discussion? Does it force accommodations to transgender people to use the bathroom that they're most comfortable in? What impact does this have on that situation?
I think, and to paraphrase Justice Gorsuch, that those are issues to come. It does not decide those issues. In the first place, it would only decide those issues as it relates to, from a federal level. Now, some state laws already deal with those issues, but from a federal level, the only place that this would impact would be in the workplace, not in schools or anything like that, just in the workplace. So the question then becomes, is a refusal to accommodate, for example, firing someone because they use the restroom of the gender to which they identify. And to fire someone on that basis certainly looks like discrimination on the basis of gender identity, which would be implicated by this decision. But decisions as to schools and public restrooms, those were not at play in this case anyway. But certainly this case will have impact on those cases when they come forward in the future because the language is similar.
And you're a scholar and attorney. You focus a lot on the intersection of LGBT people and discrimination in the workplace. You're an openly gay attorney as well. Where do you think last week's ruling falls in the list of consequential Supreme Court judgments as it relates to LGBT history in this country?
Oh, I think in terms of if you place it in the context of LGBT history, it's incredibly important. And not that the marriage decision was not, but there are plenty of LGBTQ persons who may choose not to marry. But most of those persons do choose to work and are employed in workplaces. And therefore, this decision reaches a vast number of people and workplaces as well in a way that the marriage decision did not. And so I think it's critically important in the sort of trajectory of recognition of LGBTQ rights and freedom from discrimination in the country. There's still room to grow, but it's a big step.
Jack Harrison is a professor of law at the Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law, an expert in the field of employment discrimination. Jack, we really appreciate the time that you took to talk to us today. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Michael.
And just a reminder that we are doing our fund drive now. We had to move it from the spring due to the pandemic. So remember, on any given day, you'll hear news that makes you think. And if we're doing it right, you'll also hear something that challenges you. Occasionally, you'll also hear a reminder like this one asking you to support your favorite public radio station by contributing. It takes just a few minutes at wvxu.org or call us at 513-419-7155. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. And you can find archives of our program online at wvxu.org. I'm Michael Monks.